You're listening to a podcast from the Friends of the Minneapolis Public Library, found at www.friendsofmpl.org. This Talk of the Stacks event was moderated by Minnesota Public Radio's Carrie Miller. It features authors Barry Jean Borich, Shannon Olson, Faith Sullivan, Anne Ursu, Ka Vang, and Wang Ping. It was recorded live from the Minneapolis Central Library's Paulette Hall on April 24, 2008, and presented by the Friends and U.S. Trust.
Welcome to the Minneapolis Central Library and to the Talk of the Stacks, a reading series exploring contemporary literature and culture presented by the Friends of the Minneapolis Public Library as well as U.S. Trust. I'm Anita Ducor, Executive Director of the Friends. I'm not sure if you've heard about the great news, but on June 1st, four libraries in Minneapolis will have Sunday hours. We will be open. We will be open noon to 5 at North Regional, Hosmer, Eastlake, and here at New Central. The Friends applaud the county commissioners for investing in our libraries and recognizing that access to information is a right, not a privilege. This is a great step towards restoring service hours in Minneapolis. We're also planning a fantastic party with our colleagues with the Hennepin Foundation and with 26 suburban Friends organizations. And I think you all received off-the-shelf gala information when you came in. It is May 31st. It is going to be here at Central Library. It is just going to be a fantastic evening full of just fun, and we really encourage each and every one of you to attend. Please know that we will also be fundraising for our libraries that evening. No surprise here. Now on for tonight. We are here, as I said earlier, for Talk of the Stacks. It is really my pleasure to announce that U.S. Trust has signed on again as our lead sponsor for a third year. Without their support, this series would not be possible. I would also like to extend a very special thank you to the Rake magazine, which is now publishing online, www.rakemag.com, for continuing their media sponsorship of the series, and for Majors and Quinn for handling our book sales, and that there is a portion of the books that you buy tonight also are given to the Friends. So that is fantastic as well. So buy lots and lots of books, and they will be signed here too. And finally, to Minnesota Public Radio for taking an interest in our series and recording the Talk of the Stacks tonight, and it will be for a future broadcast. Now let me introduce Steve Kelleher, our Senior Vice President at U.S. Trust, our sponsor, to introduce tonight's program. Thank you again.
Thanks, Anita. And again, I'm Steve Kelleher from U.S. Trust, and welcome everyone to the 22nd edition of Talk of the Stacks. Tonight is a time to celebrate. We are here to launch the book Riding Shotgun, an anthology from a group of America's award-winning literary women, tackling our most challenging and important topic of our series to date, motherhood. Riding Shotgun, Women Write About Their Mothers, published by Minnesota Historical Society Press, and edited by Kate Kaiser, is a collection of 21 diverse stories that look behind the cliche of motherhood. To give this book proper examination, we've enlisted the help of literary expert Carrie Miller. A familiar voice to many of you, Carrie Miller is the host of Minnesota Public Radio's Mid-Morning. She will moderate a conversation with six of the contributing authors this evening. Between the six of them, they have published more than 30 books and receive countless awards and accolades. Excuse the very brief intros, but we only have 1 hour for the show. Please welcome Barry Jean Borich, the author of My Lesbian Husband, Landscapes of a Marriage, winner of the American Library Association GLBT Nonfiction Book Award. Shannon Olson, the author of Welcome to My Planet, Where English is Sometimes Spoken and Children of God Go Bowling. Wong Ping, poet, essayist, and fiction writer with 7 books, including most recently The Last Communist Virgin, winner of the 2008 Minnesota Book Award for Best Novel and Short Story. Faith Sullivan, a book club favorite and author of 8 novels, including Gardenias, What a Woman Must Do, and The Cape Ann. Anne Ursu, the author of the novels The Disapparition of James and Spilling Clarence, and the children's trilogy, The Cronus Chronicles. Ka Vang, playwright, fiction writer, and poet. Her play, From Shadows to Light, was produced by Theater Mu at the Mixed Blood Theater. And finally, tonight's host, Carrie Miller.
We're gonna bring the authors out, get situated, adjust the mics, and then we'll begin. So pretend we're not doing this. For authors, if you'll come out. Here comes our trusty Mike DeMarc to adjust the microphones. Great to see everybody here. We thought with the rain and the traffic that we might not have a full house. Wow, how fantastic. How many of you have been to a Talking Volumes? Well, we're good. Oh, that's so great. I'll just advertise our the launch of the spring season while we're waiting here. We have Michael Ondaatje coming on May 27th. Can't wait for that. Author of The English Patient, and he's got a new novel out called Divisadero. And then on June 12th, Judy Blume is going to round out the season. So the tickets are selling now, and they're selling quickly for both of those shows. But it would be great if some of you would come to those shows. Oh, and by the way, Cokie Roberts is going to be at the Fitz on May 22nd. So I have a busy late May and June. But so I hope you'll think about that. Everybody, how's everybody feel?
Good.
Good?
Yes.
All right. Okay, here we go. Good evening and welcome to a special conversation here at the Minneapolis Central Library. I'm Carrie Miller, host of Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. It's a pleasure to see all of you here in the audience, but I have to admit to a certain amount of trepidation as we begin a conversation about mothers. Because even though, you know, I've led discussions on race and politics and human rights, and I've flung questions at the likes of Jesse Ventura, and I talked about string theory with Marilyn Robinson, and believe me, that took some guts. You know, there's something about plunging into a conversation about your own mother, other people's mothers. It just gives me that kind of tight feeling in the pit of my stomach. So we'll find out if some of the authors share my trepidation tonight. You know, maybe it's because Catherine Kaiser notes in the introduction to this book, that these mother and daughter bonds are relationships that are rich with complexity and control, rebellion and intimacy. Maybe it's because, as Oscar Wilde once said, all women become like their mothers. That's their tragedy. No man does. That's his. Or maybe it's as J.D. Salinger once said, all mothers are slightly insane. So given all of that, who knows what's going to happen as we embark on our conversation tonight. Among these authors who have all contributed essays to a new anthology titled Riding Shotgun, Women Write About Their Mothers. We're going to talk about Anne Ursu's docu-mama, who discovered her artistic heart rather late in life and became a memory keeper in a unique way. I'm going to ask our guests about the power of a mother's myths and mantras and mystery. And we're going to find out how they knew and how they didn't know their own mothers and what they think about being daughters. And we're going to hear some excerpts from some of the essays. So again, thank you all for coming. Let's start our conversation. And Shannon, you get to go first after all of that. You say in your essay, I think I must have been and probably still am a real mystery to my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Oh, gosh, why not? Well, you know, I mean, I think I'm as much a mystery to her as she is to me, in that you can never really know anybody completely, you know. And so I think that was the challenge of trying to write about her for me, because I always think, you know, and I've written about my mom before in both of my novels, and I always feel it's sort of like a fly's compound eye, you know, like there are all these little angles that form one whole view, and you only ever get to a few of them, probably, you know, that she has her own story to tell, and so I'm telling my, you know, I'm offering a portrait from my vantage point,
right?
And so, you know, having written about her quite a bit, she's still a mystery to me.
What do you think?
And
she,
I'm sure she just looks at me and goes,
"What happened?"
Yeah.
What do you think she doesn't know about you?
So, what doesn't she know? Well, I think she knows quite a bit about me. I can say, you know, after I wrote about her in my first book, I think she was quite surprised, you know, at what I had to say about who I am in the world and how she had shaped me. And so, you know, when she was reading the first book before it was ever published, she was really enjoying herself. And I'd call her and I'd say, you know, Mom, what are you doing? I'm reading this great book. I'm reading, you know, what are you reading? I'm reading your book, silly. And then that's nice, you know. And then I didn't hear from her for like 3 days. And I called and, you know, and she was not pleased. So what doesn't she know? I think at this point she probably knows quite a lot about me. But who, I'm not able to answer this question.
You did a good job. Who else here feels like they're a real mystery to their mother? Faith?
I think that because it's your mother, you expect you're going to know. So, I mean, why my mother, for Lord's sake, why wouldn't I know a lot about my mother? But I think mothers withhold a lot of information about themselves. Oh, sometimes I think they're mistakenly that their children will be, oh, I don't know, shocked is perhaps too strong a word, but disappointed, or, you know, that they'll have some sort of negative feeling about really knowing a lot. I think so.
How much did your mother reveal to you? I mean, at what point did you feel like you really knew
more
her?
Than I wanted to know.
Do tell.
I'm
like
speaking
what?
For others now. Well, my mother was a very, there was no shutting my mother up.
She told you more, too much information?
Oh, yeah.
TMI with your
way.
Mother?
Yeah. And actually, my grandmother mainly raised me, but when my mother was around, I mean, it was everything, much of which you didn't want to know. Yeah.
Who else? Barry, how about you? I mean, do you think in some ways you remain a mystery to your mother?
Oh, absolutely. But I think some of that is, you know, there's such a myth of the mother-daughter. There's, you know, this rosy, domestic, you know, blissful image that, you know, and I think we're supposed to live out something that our mother may have wanted or didn't get to have. And so, you know, here we are, human beings making our own way, and sometimes we don't look a lot like what our mother imagined, you know?
That's one of the things that I wondered about. Ka, Anne, jump in here. I wonder how expectations play a role in the complexity of the relationship between the mother and daughter. The mother thought it was going to be like this. The daughter is somebody totally different. What do you think?
Well, expectations, wow. I can say, well, to answer your first question, I think that I'm still a mystery to my mother, and my mother's still a mystery to me. However, in that mystery between us, I think she revealed a lot to me, you know, and I think she revealed too much to me, but of things that I wasn't interested in, you know, yeah, and then didn't reveal things that I wanted to know about. She revealed too much of, like, you know, her neuroses and her fears, you know, and her challenges, you know, and so that I don't make the same mistakes. But at the same time, you know, I don't think that she told me enough about what it was like to be a woman in a man's world, you know, and the and those kind of challenges.
And expectations.
Well, I have this very bizarre, unusual relationship with my mother, in that it's quite devoid of angst. We get along.
Oh, how boring!
I know. We get along very well, which was actually when I sat down and thought about writing this essay. You know, well, what am I going to do? There's no, you know, hanger throwing or anything like that.
How did you ever become a writer?
Yeah, no conflict.
Well, that is the question. I think, you know, something that everybody goes through is this this point in your life when you realize that your parents are actually, you know, functioning people on their own, mm-hmm. and they have lives on their own. And my essay is actually in a way about my mother discovering that about her own mother. But I think I can't remember whose it is, but somebody basically has to have that realization at 5 in here, and that becomes a little bit, you know, that's a little bit too soon. I think that, you know, you need this time when you've got this person who seems like they're revolving around you. But, you know, it's been wonderful for me as an adult to get to know my mom as the person that she is.
I was thinking, Ping, when Faith was talking about too much information from a mother about your story, some of the things that your mother wanted to tell you that you didn't necessarily want to know, including about her romances.
Well, talking about my mother, I don't know. I don't think I know much about my mother, and at the same time, I think I know everything about my mother from myself. So I kind of use my mother as a mirror. As a child, I never wanted to say I don't want to be anything like my mother. And the older I get, the more I realize how much I like my mother. And, you know, growing up, I was so afraid of my mother. She's just so beautiful, so strong, walk, you know, with such beauty and grace. And I was just so ugly, you know. And I was the ugly child, right, of the family. And so I couldn't talk. When I saw her, I just tongue-tied totally. And so growing up, this deep desire, I wanted to have a conversation with my mother. And thank Katie, you know, gave me this chance to, you know, to actually write about her. But I have always been afraid writing about her. But everything I write is about her and is my conversation to her and mm-hmm. with her that I couldn't have. And the irony is I started writing in English so that my mother couldn't read it.
Even though it was about her.
Because I know that she would be very mad at me. And at the same time, you know, but I still gave her, when the first book came out, I proudly presented to her. And she doesn't know a word of English. She just knows what I wrote about. She just got really mad at me.
Intuitively, she knew.
She just knows. So, you know, this, like, mystery between the relationship, mysterious relationship between mother and daughter, you think you don't know, but you actually know much more. And when you don't think you know anything, you actually, you know, there is this unbroken ties between mother right. and daughters.
Faith, how about this Oscar Wilde claim that all women become like their mothers, that's their tragedy, and men don't, and that's theirs?
Well, I can only speak from my own experience, and I don't think I have become much like my mother. Maybe like my grandmother, but not much like my mother.
Why not?
Well, my mother in many ways was the bad example that you learn from.
This is so interesting. Go ahead.
Well, in the little part that I'm going to read, I talk about the fact that my mother, I say in here that she was married 6 times, and I realized later I was totting them up, she actually was married 7 times. So you can write that.
One man twice, or how'd you lose track?
Oh, one man 3 times, yeah. But then there were 4 others.
Gosh.
Yeah, so when I say, you know, by example, I have learned not to be my mother, I hope.
Shannon, how about that? You think Oscar Wilde's right?
Well, you know, I feel like I've sort of struggled mightily to become my own person, and yet I hear myself say, oh, God, oofta, you know. Oh, Mom, is that you? So I don't know. My mom is kind enough to remind me that I'm, you know, partly my dad's fault, too. So maybe that's part of it.
You think there's something different about the relationship between mother-daughter and mother-son?
Oh, yeah. I do think so, but I'm not sure why exactly, you know, what that has to do with it, except for I think that you were mentioning that you see a reflection of yourself. It's like looking in the mirror, yeah. You know? And I think there's that tendency in mother-daughter relationships to see I've often wondered if my mother looks at a smaller version of herself, or if I'm, you know, her ambassador in the world, you know, go represent me.
If that's true?
If that is true.
What if it is?
We're doing all right, I guess. You know, but I think a lot of the things, I think it's both mirror, it's reflection and projection. I mean, mm-hmm. I always thought, I wrote in my essay for this book about all the articles and clippings my mom always sent me. And I always thought they were like articles about what's wrong with, here's how to fix you. You know, here's something about time management. Here's something about, budgeting. Here's a sweater that would look good on you, you know. And I just thought it was all sort of the spirit of improving me, because I wasn't fine the way I was. But now I sort of think more that, she was thinking about the ways that she had shaped herself and mm-hmm. learned how to get by in the world, and she was just trying to share that with me. It wasn't.
When I was reading the essays that had been contributed to the anthology, I was thinking about a Talking Volumes evening that we had a year or so ago with Edna O'Brien, and her newest novel, I'm sure she's working on a new one now, was called The Light of Evening. The dedication said, for my mother and my motherland. And it was so interesting because she talked about how she'd lived away from Ireland for 30 years. She'd had a very close letter writing relationship with her mother, but they hadn't seen each other all that much. And she said every time, especially in this novel, but every time she sat down to write, the mother, the motherland, right there in the front of her mind.
Yeah.
Why, do you think? I mean, what?
Well, I think in her particular case, you know, she was not exactly driven out of Ireland, but they were not unhappy to see her go because of the way she'd written about Ireland and the church. But her mother was something, I think, separate from that, from mm-hmm. Ireland. And so she couldn't help but be drawn back to her country. I think especially because she'd been sort of driven out, that she would be drawn back to it and never, I think, stopped wanting to be with her mother.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember when we were in Ireland, they have a museum of Irish writers. She was the only woman in the museum.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Ping, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I just wonder, thinking of myself, you know, leaving China, coming to America 20 years ago, and writing the second language, right? When I discovered, when I started writing, I was writing in 2 languages. And very quickly, I realized the Chinese one, which is my mother tongue, is very, very different from the English writing. And the English, I was so much free and happy and playful, bold. And in Chinese, I was just very refined. You know, all the good manners, a good girl, I was there in Chinese. And suddenly I realized, you know, how much I was bound by my mother, by my mother tongue. You know, so the motherland has a lot to do with how our consciousness and unconsciousness and our ways of thinking and looking at things are bound by our mother tongue. So it's like invisible whipping within us, telling us where to go. And so when I discovered that, I just like, just so much joy and freedom. I said, I'm going to start writing in English, but mother tongue is always my ground.
Right. You know? God, do you have some thoughts about that?
You know, I find it to be the exact opposite wing for me. For me, I think when I write a Hmong and I have my Hmong imagination opened and on, I'm much more free because I feel like I'm channeling the spirits of my ancestors, you know, 4,000 years of storytellers, mm-hmm. you know, running through my veins, and I'm free and I don't have the constraint of a linear Western story to tell. I can tell stories of magic and, you know, and fanciful things happening. And so I kind of, it's like kind of the opposite. When I write in English and when I write it from an American perspective, it's actually, I think it's very limiting and narrow. And when I am able to infuse the American and the Hmong, that's when magic really happens. Because it's, you know, it's my dual identity. It's who I am.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the history of storytelling. And I think in your story, you talk about how your mother has developed this whole side of being a storyteller and a memory keeper, and it's something that the family had to get used to the idea of, in a way, right?
My essay is about my mother deciding at a late age that she was an artist, and she had gone through her life feeling that she was, you know, her mother and her older sister had been intellectuals, and she thought she was a failed intellectual, and she realized that no, she was an artist. And as soon as she said that, we said, yes, you are an artist, because she was she would, you know, just do these things on her computer and they would be so beautiful. And so then she started taking painting lessons and she'd come up with these masterpieces, and, you know, and she'd just brush them off. Oh, you know, anyone could do this. And we'd say, no, mother, no, most people can't do that. So that was sort of watching her sort of become herself at 60 was really, 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 really something.
Will you read an excerpt?
Yeah.
Then and tell us a little bit about where we are in the essay.
Well, this is a little after Mom has announced that she's going to be an artist, and I think it's actually pretty self-explanatory. Let's see. About a year ago, my mother announced she wanted to make a Ken Burns-style documentary about her parents' experiences during World War II as a family keepsake. My brother and I eyed this prospect with some trepidation. When Mom gets into a project, she tends to become rather consumed by it. We refer to the time she threw a retirement party for my father as the year there was no Christmas. And indeed, she threw herself into it entirely. Suddenly, her office was filled with piles of books and videos. The sound of gunfire and air battles frequently emanated through the house. And we lived our lives to a constant top hits of World War II soundtrack. Whether coming from the stereo or from my mother herself, unconsciously humming Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Staying there one night while my husband was out of town, I woke up at 3 a.m. to hear music from the room below. I went downstairs and Mom was sitting at her desk downloading music from iTunes. I couldn't sleep, she breathed wide-eyed. I had the best idea. She had been looking for a way to make a transition into the start of the war. She was going to go from some idyllic pictures of my grandparents' home life right into Pearl Harbor, but didn't know quite how to get there until that moment. I'll play Beyond the Blue Horizon under these pictures, see? I stared at her, uncomprehending. How does it end? She prompted. This I knew. Beyond the Blue Horizon was one of the lullabies Mom sang most when I was a child. I ran quickly through the lyrics. My life has only begun. Beyond the blue horizon lies a rising sun. Rising sun, she repeated, staring meaningfully at me. I have footage of a sky and then a Japanese fighter coming out of it. Isn't it cool? I had to admit it was. Mom, maybe you should go to bed. You can do this in the morning. I can't, she whispered mischievously. I'm too excited. My father called a few months into this project. Your mother's movie, he said, I've seen a little bit of it. It's really good. It is? Yeah, really, really good. We never thought it would be. You just don't expect your 63-year-old mother to disappear into her office for 6 months with a Mac, boxes of photos and letters, and the entire Time Life World War II video collection and come out with something that should be on PBS. And yet it should be. It's professional, engaging, and heart-wrenching. Using photos, music, home movies, documents, and archival footage, Mom explores her parents' own love story against the backdrop of the coming war.
You're listening to a conversation with six authors at the Minneapolis Central Library. They've all contributed essays to a new anthology titled Riding Shotgun, Women Write About Their Mothers. I'm Carrie Miller. I'm curious about where's the movie at now? Is it world release or something? Or?
It is. There's a first volume, The Pre-War Years, and a second volume, The War Years. And
oh my gosh.
They're both amazing. And, you know, and my dear mother sitting over here blushing.
Oh, she's here?
Yes, hi, Mom. I just made it worse. She brushes this off. Oh, anyone could do this. And no, they actually can. And she is a natural storyteller. And I as someone who does this professionally, I'm in awe of her.
Wow. Who is there anybody else's mother who's here tonight in the audience? No? Okay. You get to be the standard bearer for everybody. That's a lot of responsibility, isn't it? You're representing all mothers.
I didn't have the guts to invite my mother.
Really?
Yes, why? But I just don't know. I was afraid that I was just going to look at her and start crying or just run the other way. She hasn't read the story.
I was just going to ask you, why not?
You know, this is her life, and I'm writing about it. I feel like I'm an interloper. I feel like I'm intruding on her life, you know, by writing about it. But it's also my experience, so... You know, it's my life, so I can write about it too, but it's also her life.
Do you feel like you have the right to do that?
I do, because I used to be a former reporter. So I feel like I have a right to write about anything that I want to.
All the rules are broken if you're...
yeah. You know, I think she's a fascinating woman. She has many admirable qualities, and I want to write about that.
Will you tell us a little bit about the story that you've written?
Oh, the story is about my parents' marriage and how they got married, and my mother is the second wife.
That's...
And it's also a reflection of my own failed marriage. I wrote it when I was in San Francisco last year, unable to walk. You know, not really. I was there for professional training development for about a week, and I couldn't really walk. So I would just go to my training sessions and then go back to my hotel room and write the story.
Wow. You know, I got the impression from reading the story that you were pretty judgmental at a young age of your mother's decisions and the choices that she made, but you'd come to a certain understanding with some distance. Is that right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, I'm still trying to understand my mother and her decisions, even tonight. I think it's going to be a lifelong process of understanding her, but I knew that I needed to understand her in order to understand myself.
Yes.
Yeah, I knew that there was a link between that, and I came up with that myself without the help of a psychiatrist or anything like that. I just wanted to say that.
That was not expensive therapy that yielded that insight.
No.
Who else shares that here? Barry?
Well, I think what's interesting to me, I've written about my mother many times, much to her chagrin. And I've told her story of in another project. I told her incest story. I've told her I've told stories about our lifelong kind of battle with each other. Mm-hmm. And this piece, when Kate asked for a piece about my mother, you know, I was already working on a book that was about places and what our attachment to places are about. And I always wanted to write about my mother's repetition of the line when we were in the projects. She grew up in the projects on the south side of Chicago, she, it's her big story that she's repeated over and over and over again in a million different ways. And I'd always wanted to write about that. I could never get to it. And I'd always wanted to write about this, the house I grew up in, which was across the street from this abandoned factory that we called the Rat Factory. And that was this kind of haunting image of my childhood. And I had this idea for the longest time that I would write about both these things. And it wasn't until Kate's assignment, thank you, that I brought those together all around an argument about a percolator, oddly. And by putting those stories together, I realized the ways that we are the same, because most of our arguments are about the way we aren't the same. Most of our arguments are about why I am my father's daughter and not like her, and why I refuse to be like her. And in linking kind of imagistically these two stories we have in the back of our minds, I found a connection I didn't know was there. So that was fascinating to me.
One of the things that you say in your story is that you and your brother grew up within my mother's mantras. What were they?
Just that line when we were in the projects, when we were in the projects, you know, we didn't have the things you have when we were in, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, I used to have to walk 5 miles to school
in the snow, kind of right.
You know, and it was also kind of a justification for any time she felt uncomfortable or out of place, or which I think is my mother's story, is a story of feeling very out of place in a world that seems more comfortable than her. And my own inheritance of that tendency has been mysterious to me, but also kind of explained by her story, by her repetition of you know, when we were in the projects.
Right.
You
know? Who else has a mantra that they can remember that their mother sang?
Oh, my mother, of course, he would say, "棍棒底下出孝子" is, what's the English equivalent? Is the good son comes out of the rod? What's the, you know, you have to beat your child.
Oh.
What's, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so she used her rod a lot. And
truly believing that, huh?
Yeah. And I often wonder, so out of that, you know, after she hit me, I was about 5 or 6, and I swear, you know, to the dusk, I said, the setting sun, I said, I would never beat my children, you know, and I never did. Actually, once or twice, I slapped them, and I was so remorseful, I wrote, 10 poems to, like, ask them for forgiveness.
Did it work?
Yeah, but at the same time, and I'm very grateful to my mother's training, because we really grew up, you know, in this very hard time. I grew up during the Cultural Revolution, and also I just really felt I grew up to fulfill the unfulfilled desire or the wishes that mother couldn't. You know, my mother is very, very smart woman, very creative, and very big-hearted, and she really wanted to go to college, and she could. She got into the best college, you know, in Shanghai, but her family had no money, and her mother, my grandma, wanted her to work to start supporting the family, so she obeyed, and that is the most bitter experience in her life, you know, and she still carries it. So I think, you know, when I was 14, actually 13, at the time the Cultural Revolution, there was no hope ever to go to college for me, but I just had this seed of determination that I will go to college at any cost, you know. And at that time, I didn't know, you know, what I was doing. And now when I was writing this essay, I realized I'm really living the life my mother wanted to live so much, you know. And I did go to college after like 10 years working in the fields, you know, jumping through so many hoops, you know, to get to college.
Faith mantras.
Oh, well, I was a depression baby, and so the mantra always was, get a teaching certificate because you never know.
You can always fall back on teaching. Did you?
Yes.
You did? You obeyed your mother's mantra.
I didn't teach very long.
Why not?
I didn't really think I was a good teacher. And so, and besides, it was driving me crazy. so that I, yeah, I got out of it as, almost as soon as I could. Yeah.
How about an excerpt from your essay? And you'll, right. Perhaps you'll tell us a little bit about where we are in the...
Well, this is the opening of the essay. My mother had careers and marriages. I lose track of the number of careers, but I remember the number of marriages, six, well, actually, seven. I forgot Bill Williams in Coos Bay, Oregon. one of the two I never met.
What, because the marriages were so short?
Yeah, oftentimes, yes. 3 times to the same man. She believed, like Auntie Mame, that life was a banquet, and she was damned if she was going to miss a thing on the table. From the time I was 9 or 10, she was a frenetic butterfly flickering in and out of my life, a woman of enthusiasms, fast cars, memorable hats and drinks with funny names, and dauntless affections, friends everywhere. She was not, I'm afraid, a woman of great steadfastness, nor perhaps even wisdom. But she had the good sense to see that Grandma's house was the place for me and later for my brother. And Grandma stood at the door holding it open, then and always. Come in, child, she told me on every return, folding me to her. Mm. Grandma's house, it stands even today at 504 Fifth Street Southeast, Pipestone, Minnesota. Not a ghost house, but a clapboard structure with a wraparound sleeping porch where I lay on summer nights those years ago, wrapped in the susurrus of women's voices in the next room. The women now are ghosts.
Thanks. Yeah. Why do you think your mother married so many times?
Well, my mother was a really typical middle child in what we think of the middle child. The oldest child was a son, and so the sun shone on him, and the youngest one was an adorable little girl, and my mother always felt that she was entirely left out of the family. Mm-hmm. And so I think she was in a search all her life for some payback, some reward for being a middle child.
At what point do you think you really began to understand that about your
mother?
Maybe
just this minute.
Really? It was a revelation.
Really? Really, yes. Yeah.
Let me ask some of our other... Shannon, at what point do you think you really start to understand what makes your mother tick?
Oh, wow, that's a tricky question. What makes her... I'm not really sure what makes my mother tick.
I wish she was here tonight.
She's in Portland visiting the grandchildren, which Trump book releases. So. Unfortunately.
So...
Yeah. What makes my mom tick?
Well, when do you think you started to figure it out or try to figure it out?
You know, I really think writing, I have to say thank you to Catherine, that writing this essay really helped me sort through some things. I was physically sorting through all these articles that she had sent me, and I knew that's what I wanted to write about, but I didn't know what I had to say about it, and, there were hundreds and hundreds of these things, and... and some of them just little tiny clippings, to go on a mountain, excursion with Don Shelby, and it's like those sorts
that would
of,
be something you'd want to say,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Clipping
and,
about that.
And so, I think I started actually to get a sense of what, maybe not what makes her tick, but what she struggled with, because mm-hmm. I started to see each article as a reflection of something that was actually probably quite personal to her. I mean, she probably wanted to go away with Don Shelby. I don't know. But
you could live vicariously. Yeah. She could live vicariously through
exactly.
You and Don Shelby.
Exactly. But I thought, there were articles on, I sort of developed, I noticed there were categories. There was like depression, finances, nutrition. I can't remember now how I divided them exactly.
Would your mother mail these to you, or she would hand them to you? And
both. She would mail them to me, and then she started. I don't know if she saw them as like little carrots to get me to come home, but she would say, "I clipped an interesting article for you. It's in your basket." There's a basket at her house where she puts the articles so that I can get them when I get home. And I started to realize these are things that are important to my mother, and she's letting me know, here's what you struggle with in the world. Here are things to think about. You know, you need fiber. You need vitamin B.
You need Don Shelby.
You need Don Shelby. He's someone's fiber.
He's busy tonight, so he's not listening. So. Anne, when do you think you began to understand what makes your mother tick? If you have.
Well, my mom changed a lot as I grew up, and really, as I said earlier, sort of just became this more person who was much more open to the world as I grew older, and I think part of that was coming to understand her own parents. But I guess I'm always trying to understand her. I think that's we're very similar. So understanding what makes her tick is a lot of understanding what makes me tick, I think.
Kat, go ahead.
You know, I don't think I was really interested in really? Knowing how my mom ticked until my marriage began unraveling, and that was about the day after I got married. But. No, seriously, that was about a year ago, you know, that I started really, really trying to get at whom the essence of my mother, and not just her as my mother, but her as a woman, you know, a separate woman, you know,
from me. Why do you think the unraveling of your marriage made you curious about what your mother had been through?
Okay.
is this feeling like analysis?
Yeah, no, this is feeling like a session. Well, with my psychiatrist. I think it's because I understood that there were a lot of qualities that that she had that I had, and that I was making some of the same mistakes that she had made, and I saw that there were parallels in our lives, even though she grew up in Laos and was a second wife and. You know, had some sort of education, but, you know, I had a higher education than she did and grew up here in America, you know, and I was straddling two cultures growing up and trying to understand that dual identity. But I understood that even though we had these different experiences, there were essence of each other that existed between us and that I was making the same mistakes that she had made. I needed to understand that.
Barry, what's the thing you wish you could say to your mother that you can't? Oh, why'd she choose me for that question?
Well, the first thing might be that your picture's on the cover of the Minnesota Women's Press. Because she doesn't know about this yet.
and she she's going to find she out when she sees the Minnesota Women's Press?
Yeah. What do I wish?
That you could say that you can't.
I think that that my life might not look very much like what she expected. I think that she expected that the next step out of the projects was somebody with a beautiful conventional marriage and beautiful conventional children's and beautiful conventional house somewhere, and so. You know, the lesbian who moves away to become a writer. That doesn't look like progress to her. But I guess I want her to, I wanted to know that it absolutely is. Probably in the most American way possible. It's just like she was the last generation that was really impacted by. By that early 20th century wave of immigration and how people move through American life, and the fact that I'm the generation that got to make choices based on pleasure and desire and the work I wanted to do, that's huge,
Yeah.
I would like her to understand that.
Yes. Faith?
Well, actually, it would be my grandmother, I guess, that I would want to say something to. And I would like to say to her that I had sort of a wild youth. And
now you tell us at the end of the conversation.
And I wish that I could say to her, I wish I had been less tunnel vision, less concerned about myself, and more understanding of her and the enormous generosity of her.
Yeah. Peng, how about you?
I think my biggest desire is maybe to spend a month with my mother.
Spend a month with her?
With her at ease, and we actually don't have to say anything. You know? I actually really don't know what to say to her, you know, except through the books that I have written already. And I've written all these books, right, for my mother, and now we have reconciled, actually, and mm-hmm. She really encourages me and gives me her proof that, you know, you are doing well, finally, right? No longer as a competition. You know, I remember the day I got into, I got into the college and to study English, you know, after this, you know, really harsh labor in the countryside. And she took me to, instead of being very proud, she took me to an English person who could speak English. Actually, he gave me a test, you know, and I couldn't read, just throw an English magazine. And of course, I didn't know much. I never studied English, you know, and she gave me that laugh and just saying, even though you went into college, you don't know anything, right? And I didn't know why she would do that until now, that her desire to go to college, right? And now finally, I think she, you know, when she went to New York, she, you know, I had this desire to spend 3 months with her, just like a mother and daughter, and it failed miserably, you know. And as she was leaving, I thought we would never see each other again. But she bought a computer, laptop, with all the money she made, you know, as babysitter. And I said, why are you buying this? She said, I want to write a book. And that moment I said, that's right. You know, she really wants, we are together, we are one, right? But, and now, you know, she's getting old, she can't walk, you know, and she finally reconciled, and I haven't been able to write, actually, you know. And so she has, like, written her book of life, you know, through me in a way, and she has her. So I just want to spend a month with her, mm-hmm. saying we are mother and daughter, we are one. And another of her mantra is she carried me in her womb for 9 months. For Chinese, that 9 months gestation is everything. You know, it's everything we know, you know, our gratitude, you know, everything is from the 9 months womb, and then we come out, and now it's time that we hold our mother within. Mm-hmm. You know,
Shannon, will you? How do I top that? Yeah. would you close our conversation? We're going to take some questions from the audience here, but sure. With an excerpt from your
sure.
story.
Yeah, happy to. I don't think it needs any setup. Okay. I think I've said what I need to say about the piles of paperwork. So and going through them, except that while I was going through them, I found ancient oatmeal packets that had wound up in the same box, and so I'm not really sure how those got there.
Fiber.
So there was some shame along with going through these. Nearing the end of the piles, I find a crumpled up poem about trusting in life's process, the slow work of God, which my mother had received at a spiritual growth class. It's about human growth potential and faith, she had written. I think faith in the process, faith in self, faith in the wisdom of a higher power who created this wonderful, complicated, interactive world. Do what you wish with it. Love, Mom. We should like to skip the intermediate stages, the poem reads. We are impatient of being on the way to something unknown, something new, and yet it is the law of all progress that it is made by passing through some stages of instability, and that it may take a very long time. I used to hate this sort of thing, what I thought of as an amateur poem, a congregation, I thought, of hallmark feelings, easy aphorisms, the poetry of rainbows and teddy bears, the glittering mystery of unicorns and vague language. But now, digging through all of these boxes, all of this stuff that I've been lugging through life, This handout from a self-help workshop my mother attended sometime in the 80s or early 90s gives me strange comfort. Another handout, perhaps from the same conference, titled Let Go, which offers a list of a dozen or so things one might release. To let go does not mean to stop caring. It means I cannot do it for someone else. To let go is not to nag, scold, or argue, but instead to search out my own shortcomings and correct them. It reminds me of a saying my mother had taped to the kitchen window when I was growing up. She had drawn a picture of a ladybug, and next to it had written, "Thou shalt not bug." It's my mantra. Yeah. I always thought it meant that we should leave her alone while she was cooking, though I found out in my late 20s that she had put it up to remind herself not to nag us children. It wasn't the kind of mother she wanted to be. It was a commandment to herself. Maybe the articles were like that masking tape message. They meant something to her that I misread. The articles reminded my mother of the past, of things she'd already learned, of adversities to which she'd already adapted. She was passing along these lessons, a sort of Darwinian survival guide. I took them as admonishments, indications that I was a three-legged frog of sorts, a mutant, maladapted creature, and so I threw them in a box, usually only glancing at the titles, not even reading her scribbled notes.
You're listening to a conversation at the Minneapolis Central Library with six authors. We're celebrating the release of a new anthology titled Riding Shotgun, Women Write About Their Mothers. Some questions from the audience. Are any of you parents? Did being a mother change your perspective and understanding of your own relationship with your mother? Yes?
Totally.
Yeah. How?
I knew from very young, like, in order to reach my mother, it had to be through my children. And I couldn't do it until I turned 40. Hmm. And I had to do it through my daughter. And I thought so, you know, firmly that my first child was a daughter, and I bought so many, like, girl clothing, baby clothing. Turned out to be a boy, but still the same. You know, and so I think the woman lineage, there's something there. So my grandma, I was thinking about my grandma, my mother, and then, you know, myself, you know, there is this line that is invisible cord, umbilical cord, mm-hmm. You know, it's always there, even though it was cut at the birth, but it's never cut.
Who else?
I had a baby about a year ago, and we were taking baby class, and my guy crawled over to another baby and plucked the pacifier out of her mouth, and this other mother just said, "No, Dash, no," and I was like, "I'm gonna rip your face off," and I actually had to move so I didn't, you know, rip off her face, and that, you know, this animalistic protection was something I hadn't really ever understood before. And now, you know, where I might have felt growing up that my mother was overprotective of me, now I realize, you let me out of your sight? What do you mean you let me go play around the block? And so, you know, I understand it. I'm sorry.
She accepts the apology. How did your own mother influence your love of writing and or literature?
Well, my mother is a natural storyteller, so I think I got my storytelling skills from her. I remember when we were young, my mom loves telling ghost stories. And myths, you know, ancient Hmong myths. She just loves telling those stories. And my sisters are here in the audience, and I don't know if they remember, but when we were kids, she would, you know, get us into the bed and force us under the sheets and then start telling us the scariest ghost stories.
What a fun mom.
Yeah, what a fun mom. I don't know if they remember. They're laughing. They remember.
Yeah?
Yeah. So that's how she influenced my creativity. And also, it's the way she told the stories, you know, to be, you know, to to allow, you know, just my creativity to grow, to never have any boundaries, you know, not to be constrained by the words or the page, you know, just to allow my imagination to grow.
We should say that your sisters and some of your friends are here because they're going out to celebrate your 33rd birthday.
Right on. Hey,
hey. Happy birthday.
Thank you. We're heading to Asia after this, not the continent. We're heading to Asia, the club. So if anybody wants to join us, please, you're welcome to.
Who else? Mothers influencing a love of writing or literature?
Oh, well, the women I grew up in an extended household of two families, my grandmother on one side of the street, my great-grandmother on the other side of the street, and the attendant younger women. And they were all storytellers, and they all were fortune tellers, although they all belonged to the Methodist Ladies' Aid. They were storytellers. Fortune tellers, and they never took money for it because that would have been gypsy to do that. But daily, women from around town would come, and they, you know, you never knocked. You just go in and you say, "Yoo-hoo! You know, are there tea leaves? Are there coffee grounds? Would you read my poem?" And they all did. And so between that and the gossip that the women stories that they told over and over and over again. I mean, they could go back for generations with gossip that, you know, they've been passing along from grandmother, great-grandmother, whatever, forward. I think that's probably where I got my storytelling love.
So how did they all learn to be fortune tellers? I mean, this was something that you were born with and into your family? Or
Yeah, I wasn't, unfortunately. But they all seemed to be. And my great-grandmother was maybe the best of them all. I mean, they read tarot cards, you name it. They did a dream interpretation. And they really were serious. I was telling someone earlier that when my children were little, we were visiting my cousin Eva, who was of my mother's generation, and my little son, who was about 5 years old, wanted his fortune told, and so Eva read the coffee grounds for him, and she said, "Now I see a big box in your future." So we remembered that. We got home. We arrived back in L.A. There was a huge box on our front porch of clothes and toys that a friend of his who'd moved to Kansas had sent. And, well, from then on, I mean.
That was it.
And one last question here from the audience. Has the book inspired you to write about your fathers?
I immediately went into a piece about my father, and that's and he's the one who influenced me. He's the one who has the same music taste and the same literary taste, and but now being buffeted by this other thing about my mother really, I think, deepened my writing about my father, because what I learned from my mother was something that she has no idea translates to literature, which is this associative kind of metaphorical way of thinking, which you know, when we were children, you know, would drive us crazy because it wasn't logical, it didn't make sense. But as a writer, I find myself doing that all the time, and it's definitely the way my mother thinks. And to have that in the background of my father's really obvious influence has been a really interesting layer.
So this is a story, a piece that you're working on now?
It's part of the larger book project. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Anybody else? Shannon, Anne, Ka.
I was just, this goes back to the question that came right before. It's a really interesting question, and I think in my writing, my dad sort of pops up, you know, in places, but I can't get him to talk about himself. And my mom, I think part of, you know, why I write about my mother is that she's always narrating. She was always narrating. You know, it's that tendency that mothers have to sort of narrate to their children what they're doing or what they're about to do, and then just sort of telling, she was always telling stories about the people in the town where I grew up. And, you know, so I think I had that sense of how, from her, how, you know, the mundane activities add up to a life, and the little stories of people sort of add up to something bigger.
Right. And that may be why women write about their mothers, because they narrate.
Right, right.
Life.
Exactly.
I thank you all very much for being here. The authors, the audience, thank you. Book signing. There's a book signing afterwards. The authors are repairing to what? Somewhere where margaritas are going to be served and they'll sign books, I'm sure, right?
Thank you, Carrie, and thanks. The other authors for your so generous with your time and a wonderful conversation. It was just an honor to have you a part of our series. This book is a collection of work from 21 authors and from the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Is that goes beyond the stage here. So before we end, I did want to recognize a few people in the audience that made this book possible that are not on the stage. So please stand as I recognize you. Anne Regan and Mary Pajoni from Minnesota Historical Press. Catherine Kaiser, the editor of the anthology. And last but certainly not least, the other contributing authors here tonight. This book is the launch for this, and this event is the launch for this book, but there'll be many other events with all the contributing authors participating, and we'll have a list of those up by the signing table. So please show your appreciation for Sheila O'Connor, I believe she's here. Morgan Grace Willow. Elizabeth Andrew. Steven Steiger Welsh and Carrie Pomeroy. For the signing this evening, we'll have all 10 authors and the editor available for signing of your book. So it's an historic evening, so don't miss the chance to buy one tonight. And the signing will be across the bridgeway. So when you walk out, just go head across the bridgeway and we'll have all the authors at the table and we'll have it quick and organized, I promise. And remember, a portion of your proceeds do support the friends and the work we do. And thank you all for coming.